You're tearing me apart!
Rebel Without a Cause, coming up next. Haven't Seen It with Tim Sestito and Tommy Tevenet. Hello, everybody. Welcome on in. Thank you all so much for listening today. This is a podcast where one of us is watching a movie for the very first time. And today, that is Tommy, on his request, mind you.
Yeah.
Rebel Without a Cause. I feel like people are going to see this in our queue list and be like, oh, Tim forced Tommy to watch a movie from the 1950s. But that's not the case.
This time it was me. Yeah, shocker. I mean, no one would have thought that.
So I've saved this question for this podcast. I hinted it at you before, and you said it's not interesting. So you can embellish a little bit if you want. But what made you go, I really need to check out James Dean? Like, I need to see a James Dean performance.
I need the James Dean experience. So basically, on Friday night, I had a bunch of friends over to watch a movie night. We did Movie Roulette. The classic movie game we always talk about in this pod. The category was sports movie, and it didn't really fit in the categories, but we were talking about James Dean at one point, and one of my buddies was like, dude, like, you haven't seen Red Buff at a Cause? It's actually great and amazing, like, really fun. And, like, drunk me was like, all right, I guess I gotta watch Red Buff at a Cause. I think I texted you at, like, 10 o'clock at night on, like, a Friday.
Yeah, you just texted me out of the blue being like, can we cover Rebel Without a Cause? I'm like, Yeah, of course. I mean, I haven't seen this since college. Maybe I know I've seen it before. I just can't remember when I actually watched it.
Yeah, at that point, I was like two or three drinks deep in. I was just like, we gotta do it. Oh my god, we gotta see Rebel Without a Cause. So this was a fun movie. I mean, I've always talked in the past about how, like, sometimes older movies take, like, a rewatch or two for me to fully appreciate, but I did not feel that case here. This movie is just, like, really riveting and plays really well. Feels almost modern in a way, which I didn't expect whatsoever.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it feels it. The pacing of it is probably the biggest surprise, I would say. And I think we were texting about this before, during our subsequent watches of this movie, where if, like, the 1950s is kind of the invention of the teenage culture, when that starts to kind of drive a lot of markets and a lot of attention, because that's just where blatant consumerism is. So it just becomes this real centerfold of attention in a way that really didn't exist beforehand. And then that just generational divide between parents and children, like, that story just will live on now for in perpetuity for, in America, at least. And this is kind of like the start of that. And I think for us, like, we don't think of the 1950s as this, like, rebellious phase. Like, we kind of think of, we probably associate that with, like, the late 1960s, with that really starting.
Like, our 1950s, like, style is basically, like, we think of, like, Pleasantville or something like that, like a ton of conformity, everyone moving to the suburbs. But when we really think about, like, modern life started in the 1950s, I mean, obviously things have gotten different and everything like that, but over the years. But
yeah, I mean, it was better back then. You could afford a home.
Yeah, it was that.
And you could drive a mail truck and afford a home with, like, three bedrooms, two bathrooms, and a front and backyard.
Just giving out homes to everyone back then.
And your wife stays at home, and that's not the case anymore. But yeah. I do feel like this movie, I feel like its signature is James Dean. And I want to talk about him, because he's almost, in a way, like, I think of him more in the ebbs of, like, the Jimi Hendrix, the Janis Joplins, the Kurt Cobains, the Jim Morrisons, like, these rock stars who kind of just died. Like, I kind of put him in that class, where he just kind of tragically died. This is what, his third and final motion picture? Like, this movie came out a month after he died, which, kind of crazy also to just, like, the star of your movie dies tragically in a car crash, and then you're just like, yeah, I mean, we're not moving the release schedule.
This actually came out after he died.
That's what I'm saying. A month after.
Oh yeah, yeah. I thought you said a month before. Yeah, this is insane to think about, because like James Dean at this point is kind of taken like a mythical figure in American culture.
Mm-hmm. I feel like everybody knows his name, you know, even if you're not really familiar with who he is, you've heard the name James Dean before. It's like, it's got that Elvis Presley. It's in the lyrics to We Didn't Start the Fire. It's got that mythos to it.
Well, it's like, I was thinking of like who has been like the closest person to that sense outside of like musicians and stuff like that. But in terms of specifically actors, the one that I really think of is River Phoenix, or River Phoenix was one of those people. Like, he was almost in a way like the James Dean in the 90s in terms of the guy who just like had so much immense potential and showed it in like two or three like really good movies, and then just like burnt out immediately and like died, and like we were just robbed of so much talent. And it's kind of almost like better for the James Dean career that we didn't have like mm-hmm. him in his 60s or 70s, going old in his 80s, becoming one of those guys like, oh, the kids today like aren't the same as it was back then. Instead, he's just this youthful spirit forever in our minds and in American culture.
Oh, yeah. I mean, the death of a figure like this, like cut early, cut tragically, like we don't, like they can live in that spirit. It's part of the reason why, like, I think of someone like Jim Morrison is like the epitome of it, where it's like he's this like hippie poet, you know, he just embodies that spirit and time. Like if Jim Morrison somehow was still alive today, and there are rock stars from his era still alive today. Rest in peace, Bob Weir, just passed away as a deadhead. Fare thee well.
And broken up, yeah.
Yeah, I was upset, you know. But he, like Jim Morrison would probably be such an insufferable human being if he was alive today.
Oh, yeah, yeah. He would be saying the most pretentious bullshit or something like that.
Yeah, and just, there is some, you know, it's obviously very sad to talk about these people's deaths. But there is, when it becomes iconography and we're discussing it in that realm, their death works in their favor.
Mm. And it's almost like we're seeing a home movie of just like this like godlike figure almost.
Yeah, it's like, because you know what? I don't know what James Dean thinks about avocado toast. I don't know what Jim Morrison thinks about avocado toast and how millennials are spending too much money at Starbucks. Like that opinion just doesn't exist, because it didn't exist at the time, and they didn't care at the time because they were 24. They were just these like young, self-centered kids.
Well, it's like the fact that like we've seen most of the guys from The Who become like old, where like their famous song was My Generation, I Hope I Die Before I Get Old. And then you have Roger Daltrey bitching about the younger generation and Brie Exit and all this stuff, where it's just like, oh, dude, like younger you would have been like, who the hell is this geezer? And so, again, we just don't have this with like these specific pop culture figures, which makes this movie even cooler, because the movie also is about like a troubled youth. And the guy dies and makes it like take another stand. Kind of like with River Phoenix, where Stand By Me has this almost like weird feature to it, where it's just like, yeah, River Phoenix, like he was stood out so much, and then now he's gone. And he died early.
Yeah. Yeah. I feel like James Dean, though, like he's, River Phoenix is a great performer. I'm not taking anything away from him. James Dean has this effortless quality. This is one of those where, like, if I was a Hollywood executive, I'd be like, cha-ching, here we go. I got my next guy for the next decade. Like, this, like, he was about to go to the stratosphere. He was about to be on that Brando level. And
Brando's another one. We saw Brando become like old and fat and like bitching at Frank Oz on like a set of a movie called him Miss Piggy.
Yeah, well, listen, Brando's a one of one, okay? Brando is infamously like the most difficult human being to work with. Like insanely talented, but just awful, just completely awful to deal with. But, you know, just like this immense talent. You know, when they bought the rights to this book, which was written by a psychiatrist. It was called Rebel Without a Cause. It's Rebel Without a Cause, the Hypoanalysis of a Criminal Psychopath. That was the name of the book. So they kind of like took this adaptation of like where youth culture was going and kind of taking it into another way. So Brando actually did a 5-minute screen test for the studio in 1947 with just like a part a partial script. There was no offer ever made. So the screen test is on the 2006 special edition DVD of the 1951 film A Streetcar Named Desire. So that does still live on, like the potential of Marlon Brando taking on this iconic role, which is just kind of a funny tidbit, funny note.
Yeah. Well, in terms of the James Dean of it all, like he was set up for basically like a Jim Carrey like breakout. Obviously, he's not a comedic star, but if you catch my drift, like basically he had three movies come out where he was the lead and star. And I feel like all those became like, except for maybe the last one, Giant. East of Eden, Rebel Without a Cause are movies that are still talked about today. Rebel Without a Cause is an iconic movie. We're like, this is the fact that like we're talking about this 70 years later and it's still just like.
The last great reference of this movie is for those who remember and have, I know a lot of our listeners have seen this movie, is La La Land.
Literally, yeah.
Like the whole Griffith Observatory part of that movie is an homage to this movie. And then you take into account the, like they go to the movie theater to watch Rebel Without a Cause. Like he takes her there on a date. So like that iconography is there. This is in The Sopranos, Rebel Without a Cause. Yeah. There's the episode where Christopher takes an acting class and he does that famous final monologue crying to his father and really like captures that performance. But that's Rebel Without a Cause, like living on. I think this is interesting. I'm going to go into what I've seen recently. And this is a movie I saw recently on a date night. I saw Zootopia 2.
Yeah.
Okay. It's a fun.
Fun segue.
I got a point. Okay. It's a fun family movie. I saw the original one when it came out. I was like, oh, it's good. Kind of the same reaction. There's a point in Zootopia 2 where I think she was the villain in the last one. She was like the Silence of the Lambs. She was like a lamb. So in this one, they're doing a prison break. They give her a cameo, and she's in there like Hannibal Lecter, Silence of the Lambs. And it's like this 15-second cameo, reference. Like, okay, all the adults are going to get it. Ha, ha, ha. Then it came out like 2 weeks after the movie came out. Like somebody who worked on the movie said like, yeah, we actually had like a 4-minute like line-for-line monologue from Silence of the Lambs, but we cut it out because we figured the kids wouldn't get that reference. And I'm just like,
yeah.
But I'm just like, especially in this age of hyper unaware, the monoculture that no longer exists, like Zootopia is like one of those big Disney movies, the sequels to franchises people love. Like that's like the remainder of like whatever monoculture existed. Like think about if you gave that just a minute of the line, just like you make a pun on Farva Beans and Chianti, right? And then some kid goes to his mom being like, or, you know, some teenager just like, what was that? Like, what was that? And it's like, mom, like, what was that? There was a scene with the Farva Beans and goes, oh, that's Silence of the Lambs. That's one of the greatest movies ever. What do you mean it's one of the greatest movies ever? It's like this. But I think of our generation,
it is funny that we were just talking about like younger figures becoming cranking about the old people.
I'm not crapping on younger people. Okay. Like they are growing up in a very difficult time to discover things. And I feel like it is the responsibility. It's more of the people who are like our age and working on it of being able to find and discover these films, like in keeping those messages onwards. Like I'm saying, like La La Land did. Like I'm saying, like I don't really remember when I watched Rebel Without a Cause, but you know what? It might have been. It might have been after I saw La La Land and I fell in love with that movie, and then I was like, I should check out Rebel Without a Cause.
Yeah, yeah.
Like
I also did watch La La Land like within the last two or three weeks. That probably was a little bit in the back of my head too.
Yeah, it's probably there. So my point is like I think to like us growing up like watching cartoons, like we covered Nosferatu. Do you know where we learned about Nosferatu?
Yeah, in SpongeBob.
In SpongeBob. And then I remember talking to my girlfriend's younger brother and I was explaining Nosferatu And they like, no idea. Mm-hmm. And I was like, didn't you watch SpongeBob? Like, it was in SpongeBob. Like, that's how I learned about it. And you're like, hands up.
Even if we go back to the Animaniacs, we have Pinky and the Brain, where the brain is like based off Orson Welles, a guy who died 10 years before that, but is still just such a figure where like they continue to over and over again. But I feel like we don't have as many cartoons that they have like just like random celebrity impersonations where like Peter Lorre was a guy who like died in like the 1960s. Yeah, I know who he is because constantly like Tim Burton would have it in Corpse Bride or something like that, or like other stuff over and over again where they have these references. And it's always a fun little thing where it's just like, for some reason, yeah, that guy's voice was great. Like, I don't know. I feel like I wouldn't be shocked if like 30 years from now, movies are still a thing and Seth Rogen's voice was something like that, where like someone just impersonated Seth Rogen.
No, seriously, because it's one of those things where we're going to take it for granted. Like, we grew up with Seth Rogen as this comedy star that's kind of just turned into this huge producer role. Like, he's just kind of like a big celebrity figure. Like, our kids 30 years from now, like, our grandkids going to know who Seth Rogen is? Like, they're not going to discover that naturally. Like, imagine being like, yeah, you know, Sonny, one of the greatest movies of all time is, it's so funny. It's super bad. It came out in 2007. Oh, hey, Grandpa, that's
40 years ago, Grandpa. Get over it.
Yeah, like, that's going to happen. Like, I tell people to watch It's a Wonderful Life, and people have looked at me before and been like, what year did that come out? I'm like, 1946. And they're just like, ugh, no. Why would I watch that? I'm like, because it's one of the greatest movies ever made. I promise you. Ugh, no. Ugh, gross. I just don't, I feel like for me personally, like, I do have an admiration for history in general, especially I love learning about old film.
As we have the old retro podcast right here, where most of our movies are at least 30 years old. But I know what you mean. I feel like there's like a certain thing to like our like generation, and like pretty much like we're the last vestige of like kids that constantly were watching cable. And one of the things of cable that probably taught us was like, we just knew so much like lexicon of older movies constantly. Yeah. And for us, maybe it was more so like 90s, 80s movies compared, but like,
and 70s sprinkled in there.
Yeah. But I feel like when I talk to like most of my younger coworkers, they don't watch anything like old. Like,
yeah.
You know, they were like, just keep with the modern ones. Or it's like, okay, I don't know, but you're missing.
They'll go see their Marvel movies and like, oh, new Indiana Jones. Okay, cool. Like, I'll go see that. But they're not really, maybe the new Christopher Nolan seems to be the only director left that has that juice, that has that pull.
Yeah,
especially with like the success of Oppenheimer, and now you have the Odyssey coming, where you're just like, okay, yeah, this guy just, he's gonna pull people in. But that was kind of tying back to my point that I was originally making with my segment. I actually think it was pretty smooth, if you ask me, Tommy.
Mm-hmm. Yeah,
so what did you watch this week?
I guess I'll talk about, like, keeping the theme of, like, getting too old. I watched a Chevy Chase movie over the weekend. And the one specifically that I watched was Vacation. First time I've seen that in probably, like, 10, 15 years.
It's a good one.
It holds up. It holds up. But it's just so funny that, like, it's almost not even shocking when you, like, think of some guys, like, became old cranks, where it's just like, oh, Richard Dreyfuss and Chevy Chase are old cranks. Yeah, that tracks completely. Because even this whole movie is like him being like snarky and stuff like that. He does shockingly have a few bits that like make him the butt of the joke, like where he eats a sandwich who's trying to be sexy in front of Christine Berkeley. And it's like, oh, the dog pissed in the sandwich. He's like,
yeah.
He's really good at that. Really good. But it's so funny that this became a guy that like pretty much ruined careers in Hollywood, or like just like, was
he ruined
the worst.
His own career. He
ruined his own career, but he was like, directors like always like said like that was the worst experience of my life. Like John Carpenter had to go through like therapy because of Memoirs of Invisible Man, basically because like Chevy Chase was such a monster to him.
Have you watched the I'm Chevy Chase and You're Not?
I still on my radar. I think that's partly why I watched Vacation. I also just got the 4K, but it's one of those things where like, you hear all these stories are coming out of the woodworks now, where people are just like, oh God, like Chevy Chase, even the person who did this documentary that just came out, like one of the first things he said was like, you're not going to get me because you're stupid.
Here's my thing though. Like, So I took a screenwriting class and the teacher worked on the Chevy Chase show. I'm like, he was telling us this. So no, and I go, well, yeah, what yeah, was yeah. that like? Because I've heard he's got a giant reputation as an asshole. And he was like, to me, he was great. Like, I came with my work prepared. I didn't like try to be chummy. I didn't try to do any bullshit with him. I just gave him my work and we went through it and he respected me for it. So he was always great to me. And I was like, wow, that's really interesting. Here's my thing. I'm not making an excuse for Chevy Chase, because especially when you hear about his stuff with Community, which it's such a shame because that's like a pinnacle high school show, I feel like, for you and I. Like, I feel like we bonded over Community at the time when it came out. Like, he's so good in that show. He's so good. And I like him with like the really heavily driven racial stuff is like very upsetting to hear.
It's also like he had a chance, like pretty much like Community was the last grasp that Chevy Chase was ever going to be a huge star
keep working.
Keep working. He could have easily, like, there's a brief period where after Community or during Community, like he was in like Hot Tub Time Machine and stuff like that, where it's like he pop up as like a fun character actor or a fun little side piece. And he could have easily had the career that like Fred Willard had, for example. The fun old guy in all the comedy TV shows.
Rob Reiner. Just he'll be like a sitcom dad, like the dad for the main character. Like he'll show up once or twice a year on each season. Like it is just fun. It's like, oh, hey, there's Chevy.
But instead, he just like squandered it all, and pretty much the whole Community thing. It's just so sad. It's just such like a dumb old man thing where it's just like.
My thing. He's like the last bastion of these really volatile personalities that just don't exist anymore because of the way the world operates. Because there's always a camera phone. There's now always somebody who's looking for a story. That's looking for a source to find out, like, hey, this person's a giant asshole. And like, I'm not defending the behavior, but it is a little sad to me that like, we might just lose the Hollywood asshole persona entirely.
Yeah. There were people to be a little too clean, too sanitized. I mean, you still have the occasional stuff where it happened, but it's just like him, especially, he just has a reputation that follows him. It's just like, yeah, the worst thing I ever worked with was a thing with Chevy Chase. So,
oh, it's like across the board too. It's not like, oh, it happened once or twice when he was on drugs. It was like, no, he was just an asshole the entire
constantly.
Time.
In and out, where he just like be people like fucking like Ivan Reitman was supposed to do Memoirs of an Invisible Man, and he didn't, was like, I can't work with Chevy. And there's the thing where like he could have easily been on like Only Murders in the Building, but the other two amigos are like, life's too short.
Literally just fuck that guy.
yeah, we're not working with Chevy, too.
There's no way. Original Vacation's great. A little sad that we're just going to lose, like, it sucks for the people that work with these people, but there is the fun for you and me, for example, in the volatile Hollywood story. Like, think of Marlon Brando. Like, who do you think was more difficult to work with? Marlon Brando, Chevy Chase? I feel like it's Marlon Brando.
I think it's close. I think that like there's a certain way, like I think it would have been easier to gain like Chevy Chase's respect or Marlon Brando's respect in a way. But like there's some characters where like, I don't know, like there's that story I told at the beginning of this pod where Marlon Brando was basically like bullying Frank Oz on the set of like, I think it was The Score. Yeah. This is like in 2002 and he wouldn't take any directions from him and just call him Miss Piggy.
that's funny.
I mean, he didn't know Frank Oz is the voice of Miss Piggy.
I mean, he drove Francis Ford Coppola insane, like literally insane on the set of Apocalypse Now.
Yeah.
Like, it's like, yeah, it sucks. But like, there is a part of me that just, it's like, I'm going to miss that guy. And it sucks because I actually, like, as a performer on the screen, like, he is just so charmingly witty. It's effortless to him.
When you bring it back to Vacation, when you see that, it's just, you'd see it just like bounce off the screen. You could see why this guy was so magnetic, so charismatic, and just like so charming in a way. It was like the asshole that you love to see just like shit happen.
Yeah.
And yeah. It is funny where it's just like, yeah, there's a reason why a screen persona was an asshole. It's like the Tarantino thing. I don't know if you heard the Tarantino talk about this, where he said like the difference between Bill Murray movies and Chevy Chase movies is that Bill Murray characters go through a lesson and change by the end of the movie. But at the end of the movie, Chevy Chase is still the same asshole and he didn't learn anything. There's no growth for the Chevy Chase character.
it's very true. And like, I mean, I know Bill Murray has like all of those guys from the 80s who are just on a ton of cocaine have a bit of a reputation to them. But it seems like Bill suffered in the 90s, tagged up with Wes Anderson and just kind of shows up and stuff and just kind of built this like mythos to him that didn't exist. And it's like he'll I met Bill Murray once. I walked into his son's restaurant in Brooklyn and I shook his hand and he was just like, oh, thanks for coming in. Nice to meet you guys. And like, that was it. And then obviously we're like trying to like watch him out of the side of our eyes the whole time. And then he walks away with like two women half his age. I was like, you know what, Bill? Like,
hats off to you.
good for you. But yeah, Chevy is just an ego that continually withers away. Like I feel like in his brain, he's still like the 28-year-old leading man that he thinks he is.
There totally is. There's like so many stories that Dan Harmon, the creative community, would have.
He's also another one, by the way.
Yeah. they're both little contentious assholes. But he said that there would be like some scenes where like Chevy would come up to him on the set of Community, like, you're writing Pierce wrong. Like, I should be the one that's going after the hot girl too. Like, he basically like wanted to be like the Joel McHale character. He's like, oh, I should be getting these plot lines too. And it's like, do you not get it? You're like fat and balding and old now. Like,
you're like 70.
That time has passed, dude.
Yeah, and,
So to tie it all back, though, and end our segment, thank God something like this never happened to James Dean. Thank God we never saw James Dean get old. It feels fucked up in a way to say that.
No, but again, I'm not talking about James Dean the person. I'm talking about James Dean the icon.
Right?
It's the icon because it's beyond screen persona. It's an Americana myth, James Dean.
Yeah. He's like a Paul Bunyan at this point for us.
Yes, seriously. he's an American, like, folktale.
Never would have happened if we saw him like pop up in the 80s and 90s as just like a cranky old guy and something, if he was in Grumpier Old Men with Jack Lemmon.
Yeah. Well, on that note, this is Rebel Without a Cause.
Explode. The pressure keeps building.
Yeah, let me get him a knife.
And building.
And
building.
You're tearing me apart!
When he blows, who will be caught in the blast? Rebel Without a Cause. 10:05 p.m. Eastern on Superstation WTBS, Monday.
All right. Rebel Without a Cause is a 1955 American coming-of-age melodrama film directed by Nicholas Ray. The film stars James Dean, Natalie Wood, Sal Mineo, Jim Backus, Ann Duran, Corey Allen, William Hopper, and Nick Adams. It also marks the film debut of Dennis Hopper, albeit in a minor role. We are on a Dennis Hopper kick right now, dude.
This is, there's two things about this month. One is it's Dennis Hopper month, apparently. And two, it's Cool Jacket month. Because Christian Slater had a hell of a jacket in True Romance, too.
So. Oh, well, believe me, I have a segment where we're going to go into a segment. Believe me, we're going to talk about the jacket, Tommy. The jacket! It was filmed in the then recently introduced CinemaScope. And if I'm not mistaken, is that the format that Paul Thomas Anderson used in, or no, that was Panavision.
CinemaScope? I feel like that might have been used in.
No, that was Panavision in One Battle After Another. Focusing on emotionally confused suburban middle-aged class teens, the film offers both social commentary and an alternative to previous films depicting delinquents in urban slum environments. The film was an attempt to portray the moral decay of the American youth, critique parental styles, and explore the differences and conflicts between generations namely the Interbellum Generation and the Silent Generation. The title was adopted from psychologist's book. Okay, we went through all this. Okay, already.
Yeah. So to answer your question, in terms of CinemaScope, first of all, La La Land was using some Panavision cameras too. So what'd you think about Robocop? So you said you've seen this before, right?
I had seen it before. I think I saw it after La La Land, if I'm going to be honest. It's like, I loved that movie so much and it played such a big, like, I'd heard of Rebel Without a Cause. Obviously it's a huge, like, you go into any film history, if you look at any list of classic American films, this one is going to show up. My grandfather talked about it. Like, it's a very famous movie. There is that hard thing where you go, like, you're a teenager. Do you really want to watch a movie about teenagers in the 1950s?
How's this going to relate?
How am I going to relate to this? Blah, blah, blah. And it's hyped. And it is a melodrama, for sure. The ending really stuck with me, but I kind of forgot everything else. Like, I remembered the beginning and the ending.
Mm.
And I kind of forgot everything else in between. Like, when we were texting about this, it's insane how this is the blueprint of, like, especially now having watched so many more films and just kind of, I feel like for us, at least for me, I don't want to speak for you, but I'm sure you feel similarly. Like, after doing this podcast for however many episodes and being able to talk about movies the way we're able to, like, you're able to, like, watch an older movie like this now and just go, like, oh, this is the blueprint. This is this is the blueprint of every teen movie you've ever watched.
Well, it is interesting when you go back almost like the source material, and this feels like it, because, like we're saying earlier at the beginning of the pod, this was the beginning of the teen culture era, essentially.
Mm-hmm. 1950s. This is Elvis. Jailhouse Rock is coming out. You know,
all this at the same time, and you have this movie that comes out, like, probably it's shocking. It didn't, like, light the box office on fire, from what I could tell on Wikipedia.
From what I can tell on Wikipedia, it made $4.5 million, and I saw somewhere on the Wikipedia article that equates to $84.7 million today. So that's pretty good.
Okay, so never mind. I wasn't counting.
Equivalent to $84.5 million in 2024.
Yeah.
It grossed $7,197,000.
Yeah.
So whatever they had, that was just domestic. This is with international.
So, but regardless, though, it's just like you see this movie, and I'd never seen a James Dean movie before, which, granted, like we said, there's only three. So there's not a lot to pick from, but, like, he's one of those guys that, like, I maybe have seen clips over the years of, like, this movie, like, through cultural osmosis on, like, random clip shows, like, best movies, but I never really knew it. And it's you watch James Dean in this movie and you immediately get it. You're like, this guy had everything going for him. He should have been a superstar right after this moment. And it's a shame
he never got he never got the moment. It's almost we have to, like, define what makes him work so well, and especially still speak to us 71 years later.
Well, I think in a way, I mean, it's the kind of thing of Brando too, that Brando and the whole generation of actors really influenced people, and Brando's method was much more method and much more, like, again, the characters, the scene and stuff like that. And you're seeing James Dean in that scene towards the end of the movie where he's talking to his dad and he's talking to his mom about how he has to go turn himself in. James Dean's playing Jim Stark. And he pretty much, like, ran some kid off the road. They play a game of chicken and he jumped out. The other kid couldn't.
Do you think that's his fault?
No.
No, it's not. No, I mean, this movie is insane, by the way.
I do understand the guilt, though, being like, oh, like, he wouldn't have done that game. It wasn't for me. But then he tells, like, his parents, like, this kid died. It's my fault. I got to confess. I got to go to the police. And, like, his parents are, like, telling him about how, like, this is going to ruin your life. And he goes on to his parents, but his mom was never really there, doesn't really care. And the acting, like, tour de force in that moment is amazing. Mm-hmm. Still plays off the screen. Like, really, all you need at the end of the day is good acting. And you have good acting in this movie. You don't need anything like that much different than just a good movie star in this moment. And like the whole like tearing me apart, I was thinking of like what it came from and what I was like, why did I know this like you tear me apart thing from? I didn't realize Tommy Wiseau doing a terrible impersonation of James Dean in The Room came from that. But still, you come back to source material and you're like, I get why that like hack like it was like, oh, let me imitate the best actor I know.
Can I make a connection also? Sorry, this just came into my brain. Back to the Future 2 and Back to the Future 3, which when they sort of just make Marty McFly's like whole personality trait about being a chicken.
Mm.
Like that's just pulled straight from this.
Yeah. And it is cool, like the different little moments of this movie. We talked about them at the beginning. I want to touch upon this now. Dennis Hopper is in this movie. And this is the second movie in a row we've covered by Dennis Hopper. And that other movie we covered was released like 40 years later in 1993, I think.
Yeah.
So it's insane the career longevity he have, where like he pretty much just like showed up as like just a random goon, but you can still feel his presence. It's like the epitome of the example of you didn't know what was riding on your bench right here. We're like, this is the equivalent of like the Nuggets when Jokic was a rookie and they didn't have him start majority of the games. And it's like, dude, like now you have the MVP on your bench.
This is Justin Turner on the 2013 Mets, and then they trade him to they cut him to the Dodgers. The Dodgers pick him up and he becomes this like superstar third baseman. There's so many sports analogies we could make.
But still, his role is really just goon, but he's still in the presence in the movie where, like, he's menacing. You can see it happen. And it makes you almost wonder, like, what the James Dean feature of this would have been. Because I could have seen James Dean being, like, an action star, like, kind of almost have a career that Steve McQueen had. I feel like that's would have been definitely his, like, type of thing where, like, you know, Dennis Hopper goes from being, like, a nameless goon and, like, pretty much a random character. He gets Easy Rider, blows up, and he becomes, like, fixture in 90s and 80s cinema because people saw Rebel Without a Cause, people saw Easy Rider and be like, I want to get that guy back in. And James Dean probably would have had, can you imagine the James Dean like Tarantino role? It's an old man.
I'm trying to think. Would he be the De Niro character in Jackie Brown?
He would have been too old by that point.
Do you think? Like Tarantino, to his credit, doesn't really do a ton of old people in his movies. And like, I can't say like Once Upon a Time in Hollywood, like James Dean would have been dead by then probably.
Yeah. Yeah.
You know, like you have to think of his early stuff. Like maybe he's an old guy in Reservoir. Like, I don't think he would be in a Tarantino movie. I'm going to be honest. I'm going to be straight up. I feel like he'd be more like, imagine James Dean as the Colonel James in Boogie Nights.
Yeah. Okay. Yeah. Yeah. Yeah.
We're having some historic casting what ifs right now. Should we just
throw them out there?
Throw out some iconic 90s movies and just see what sticks?
Yeah, you could have had him as like in Seven in the Morgan Freeman role. You know, you might have been a little too old.
Might have been a little too old. But
but there is an edge to this movie that like still plays modern. And sometimes when especially this was right within the like, you know, Code Authority era.
Heading towards the end of the Hayes Code, but yeah.
Yeah, and towards the end of the Hayes Code, but like it's still within that where like, you know, you had so many moments of like you know, movies that just felt sanitized at the time and too squeaky clean and or like, you know, not real things. This movie has some real depth to it, and it has, in a way, like one of the first gay characters in like a movie during the Hayes Code.
It's the first gay teenager for sure.
Yeah. Yeah. And in Sal Menino as John Plato.
And Sal Mineo even commented on this, where he said he noted in a 1972 interview that Plato Crawford was intended to have been gay. Speaking to Bose Hadley, it says it makes sense that Plato was killed off. He was, in a way, the first gay teenager in films. You watch it now, you know he had the hots for James Dean. You watch it now, and everyone knows about Jimmy's bisexuality, which. So it's like he had the hots for Natalie Wood and me. Ergo, I had to be bumped off, out of the way. That's a quote from the actor. I didn't know if James Dean was bisexual. I don't know that part about his life. Or if the character was. I guess I could see it. Like, he's just kind of I can't tell if that's, like, flirting or just effortless charm with everybody. But, like, Plato Sal Mineo has the hots for James Dean the second he lays eyes on that.
You see it. It's just like one of those things that, like, that we used to talk about, like, guys want to be friends of him and like girls want to fuck him. It's like, mm-hmm. I think everyone just wanted to fuck James Dean.
Yeah, man. It's really hard to like, I feel like for a younger audience and maybe people who don't have an appreciation for history to be like, this guy is effortlessly like the coolest guy you've ever seen. He is the coolest guy you've ever seen in this movie.
Just the fucking like fact that he has a red jacket, a thing that's been like popularized in popular culture. No one's put off a jacket better than James Dean. Right? You pull it off and you see it. And you're like, Jesus Christ! Like, this guy like has so much charm just from this one costume choice.
Okay, and, Tommy, I'm gonna do this to you now because this is a segment idea. We're gonna do the movie Jacket Hall of Fame.
Okay,
we're doing this right now, right here, right now. Okay. My top four is, number one is in the Indiana Jones leather jacket. It is just the most iconic leather jacket of all time. Like, I think this is number two. I think this is like safely number two. I think if we're going to, let's just call it Mount Rushmore style. Number three, I want to say the black trench coat from The Matrix. From 1999 to till 9/11, essentially, that was the style of the time. Kind of crazy when you think about it.
Mm-hmm.
And then number four, I'm going to go with the Drive jacket. Ryan Gosling,
easily up there.
The Scorpion. Maybe it's not iconic enough, but I feel like it's an all-timer. Do you have anything that you would like to add to this list?
I do want to also add the Robert De Niro and Taxi Driver army jacket.
Yeah. Oh, you know what? We're bumping, kicking Drive off the list there. That Taxi Driver jacket's going to go there over that. So
Arnold in the Indiana leather jacket Jones. In Terminator 2.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. So see,
it's good.
Yes, it's good. The jacket itself just doesn't stand out. You know what I mean? Like there has to be like. Something else to it's just a black leather jacket.
Yeah. All right. So another one I'd also say then would be, there's two more I can think of. I don't think you mentioned these two. Maverick, Top Gun.
Mm-hmm. The bomber. Absolutely.
The bomber, the leather jacket right there. And then Tyler Durden, Fight Club. Jacket right there.
I remember spending like $30 on a prop jacket. On that prop jacket on eBay in like 2013. That was my Halloween costume that year. And I did like spiked my hair. I did like the bloody thing on the face and like the glasses. And then the cigarette that I never smoked because, but just like you had to have the cigarette and then like going to the bars or whatever for Halloween and people just being like, what are you? And I'm like, Tyler Durden, it's Fight Club. And they're just like, I don't know what that is. And I'm like, oh God. But yeah,
right, there's two more I also want to throw out. One more actually. We both were him for Halloween, Marty McFly.
The puffer, you know,
it's kind of more of a vest, but it's a puffer
the jean jacket.
I think
puffer. It's a combo. It's a combo.
Yeah.
So
yeah.
I think that's second tier. I think that's second tier. Okay.
James Dean's right there in there.
I think James Dean wears his the best. Like, I don't think anybody wears it better, if that makes
sense. It literally, like, it's almost like a playbook of, like, how to be a superstar. Like, you just got to look good in a cool jacket. I mean, like, Chris Pratt had that in Guardians of the Galaxy, where it's just like, all right, that guy looked, and now you're going to be a superstar.
I mean, it's a mix of, like, the Matrix jacket with this one, just kind of, like, tied together. It just takes, like, that long coat, like, the trench coat style, and just adds that, like, red color from here. Another thought I wanted to have, and I guess I think this is very hard for us to judge here because we have a lot of conversations about cinematography, and this movie's absolutely beautiful in the CinemaScope. It's very hard for me to judge what is good cinematography in the night. Like, what did bad cinematography in a color movie look like in the 1950s? Like, what was that discernment? Because every movie you watch with like this Technicolor pan, like all these like new ways of processing film and color, is just like, it blows my mind that this is what movies used to look like.
when you think about it, outside of like maybe Ed Wood for the most part, like any movies from the 1950s that have survived on culture are the ones that like are the legends. Like, you know, this movie, like Streetcar Named Desire, stuff like that. Or
that's black and white.
They keep on going on.
Lot, and there's a lot of black and white in there too, though, like Sunset Boulevard.
I think that like, if I do have to think of like movies that like didn't blow me away with like cinematography that I've seen from that era, stuff that was just in closed sets. And like you could very tell it's a closed set. And like, I watch something like Hitchcock's a master, but I watch Dial M for Murder, and that all just takes place in an apartment, and it's shot well, but it's just like, all right, it's somewhat static or something with the camera where you're not moving around that much. And I feel like people are starting to get it a little bit more, where like you watch something like from the 1930s, like Frankenstein, for example, they just pretty much, or Dracula, which we covered, they pretty much just plot the camera, keep it straightforward.
It was a stage play.
And I think that you still had some vestiges of that when you get to the 1950s. This is an exception. This one is like really just dynamic. Even like the stuff of like the planetarium scene, that alone is very just like spellbinding. It takes you away. And it made me think of like when the last time I went to a planetarium was, because like maybe I should go to one again. That seems like a bit rock.
it seems like a good time.
Seriously.
Like a great time.
Take some edibles, go to a planetarium.
I wonder if that's just part of getting older, is when you're like these things. Like if you're 22 being like, hey, you want to go to the planetarium on the weekend? And be like, no, I'm going to a bar and I'm drinking beer. Okay, excuse me. And now you're just 30s. Like, you're just like, that sounds absolutely awesome. Just like look up at the cosmos, like learn a little bit about constellations, some planet locations.
Yeah.
Sounds kind of sick, not going to lie.
Yeah, it's like, I don't want to go back to school when you're younger. And you're like, yeah, that sounds fun. Let's do that.
Yeah, no, exactly.
But in that scene, it's just like the whole entire thing of like the deep philosophical like things of like, oh, like, you know, all of this could go away. The earth is down in like 60,000 years or whatever it is.
Well, it's weirdly a metaphor for the movie itself, especially Plato, and just kind of like a shooting star. And then also in a dark way, it's a metaphor for James Dean, is it not?
Well, this is what shocked me more than anything. I thought that James Dean was going to die at the end of this movie. I thought that was the whole thing of the movie, that like he just like it goes out in a blaze of glory or something.
No.
And maybe it's one of those things that like I confused the legend of like James Dean himself and with like the character or stuff like that. I thought it was like, oh, it'd been an ironic thing. Like almost.
So James Dean, if you don't know how he died in a car crash. He was very into motorsports and racing. He owned a 1955 Porsche 550 Spyder, and went off the road and he died. Like he slammed into the passenger side of a Ford, resulting in Dean's car bouncing across the pavement onto the side of the highway. His passenger was thrown from the Porsche while Dean was trapped in the car and sustained numerous fatal injuries, including a broken neck. So like, not good, but it's also kind of like the lifestyle. Like it think about it like this. This guy dies in a car crash. And then in this movie, the famous stunt of this movie is James Dean in a race to the edge of a cliff playing chicken.
We call that a Paul Walker special now these days.
Yeah. But
unfortunately,
also, can we talk about that car race scene?
Exhilarating.
Exhilarating.
I mean, when you talk about cinematography, the way they light it up, this movie has great use of lighting throughout. And this is one that like really stands out, where like, you know, they have like pretty much Natalie Wood, who's fantastic in this movie. Just like being like the basically the girl that like starts the race, like the rally girl, and she's the one that starts everything, and she's pretty much lit like by all these car lights over and over again, and it creates like almost like heavenly effect, and you see it like from up above, and you're like, oh my god, that's spellbinding
It's spellbinding, like that moment when like they turn on the car lights, and it's just those first two, and then it's just that wide shot, and boom, 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 and you go, oh, okay, it's on.
Yeah,
it's seriously on.
It gets you in the moment where it just like shows you like these are like people just like very much experiment the art form at that point, and it shows like how amazing it can be when like you have like lit it well.
When you think of like movie moments, like what can this medium do that nothing else can do? That it, like, you could write that eloquently on a screenplay, but you can write that eloquently in a book, in a novelization, but you can't capture it, can you? You can't capture that.
This guy who did cinematography, his name was Ernest Haller. I want to shout him out real quick because there's one huge, he was pretty much just like a workhorse. He did like a ton of filmography over the years. He's like been around since the 1920s. He even was involved with Gone with the Wind. It's a big one that he's involved with.
That's another.
That's one that we're going to have to cover eventually.
You're going to piss me off with a horror movie. My thing. Like, I want to cover Gone with the Wind. I just don't really want to watch it again.
I got the DVD recently for my mom's because, like, I just like grabbed some old DVDs and I was like, oh, Gone with the Wind, I'll take that. But again, it's like one of those things where it's like, oh, that is.
It's like quite literally it's 4 hours.
Oh, God. Well, also, like, some other movies that Ernest Haller has done, like, just some famous ones. Gone with the Wind, like I said, Mildred Pierce, Whatever Happened to Baby Jane. That movie is shot fantastically, too. So this is, like, the top of the top guy who, like, went after it. And it's funny about this movie was basically this film production. This was filmed from March 28th to May 26th in 1955, a year before James Dean died. Well, the year that James Dean died, rather. But production began, WB Warner Brothers was like, this is a B-movie project. So let's use black and white film stock. Then Jack L. Warner, the head of Warner Brothers, realized James Dean was a rising star and like pretty much like on the rise. He was a fucking shooting star. He's a hot property. He immediately was like, okay, this is being filmed in color stock immediately. And then they reshoot like portions of this movie in color just to take advantage of the fact that they're like, okay, like what are we doing here? Like, come on, we need to shoot James Dean in the best format possible. And it shows and it plays off. And I feel like Ernest Haller is probably a big part where they're like, let's go after the guy who shot Gone with the Wind. Let's just do it. And he was nominated, Haller, just to point it out, he was nominated for best cinematography at the Oscars 7 times. Just insane.
That's a Roger Dawkins run right there.
Yeah, Roger Deakins. Deakins.
I knew it as soon as Dawkins came out. I was like, Deakins. Santa Monica High School makes a famous appearance here. Maybe its first appearance here. Do you know some of the other famous movies that this has been featured in? There is another one. There is one movie that we have covered on this podcast.
It's been also uses high school. This
setting. Mm-hmm. You're gonna kick yourself.
Heathers?
No.
Scream?
No. I'll give you one more guess.
I'm trying to think what high school movies we've done. Oh, she's all that? I don't know.
A Nightmare on Elm Street.
Oh, shit. Yeah.
Fast Times at Ridgemont High.
Oh, yeah.
The Graduate.
Okay.
The Way, Way Back. The Edge of 17. Cruel Intentions. 17 again. That's one of the better high school shooting locations ever. Like that's a stacked resume right there. It's incredible. It starts with this movie. Because I was like, what, the weird we're thing about this movie, look at the exterior.
Like you get it immediately. Like then you get it immediately. Like, oh yeah. It's a weird thing. Like we talked about James Dean having a mythical figure, but he's not the only one in this movie that has died in like weird fucking circumstances.
You're stealing my points here.
Yeah.
You're stealing like, what I want.
Natalie Wood pretty much just like is like one of those people that like you see the scenes. Like for those who don't know, Natalie Wood has died under very mysterious circumstances. She drowned on a boat with Robert Wagner and Christopher Walken. Drowned is the official term. Like, so we don't know everything that happened right there. To this day.
Well, there is the belief that she was pushed off the boat and killed. It is also referenced in Once Upon a Time in Hollywood with Cliff Booth and his wife. Like, that was a very clear Natalie... That wasn't a subtle Natalie Wood homage, was it?
No.
In Once Upon a Time in Hollywood. But, so this is, like, a very famous disappearance and murder. Or, I guess it's just a drowning, but it's most likely a murder. And Christopher Walken was on that boat, which is insane.
yeah, weird to think about. But then also, like, you have, like, Sal Menino. I didn't even know this until just now. He was stabbed to death in, like, 1976 when he's, like, in his, like, late 30s. It's, like, these three guys just, like, immediately that were, like, three people that were big parts of this movie, the top three build, just all died. And it creates just, like, again, another just, like, legend about this movie. Where, like, you see Natalie Wood and James Dean. And it's insane that the two of them are sharing scenes together, on the scenes together. It's like, both these people died in the, like, most wild ways possible. You wouldn't expect it at all from a Hollywood star. Neither of these people got to be old.
Yeah, I mean, and it kind of goes back to the planetarium thing that we mentioned, that mythos, like that shooting star of the world ending, like it's ominous that it's there. But do you think, if all three of them were still alive today, because realistically, by their birth years, they'd be like 85, 90 years old. They'd be somewhere in that range.
Yeah, yeah.
Do you think this movie, like, still has the legs if all three of them are still alive?
I think that out of anyone, you need James Dean to be the one. This is so grim to talk about, but I feel like with James Dean dying, I feel like...
It's sad, but it's like...
No, but literally, James Dean dying, like, probably just, like, made this movie into a whole other tier of just, like, stuff like that. Where, like, you have, again, like, Stand By Me is another one like this, where it's just like, oh my God, like, this guy, like, died a big thing. The only one, other person I can think of is, like, Anton Yetchin, but he wasn't the same tier of those two guys.
So there's only one that I can think of. I'm surprised you didn't think of this, because we lived through this. Heath Ledger.
Yeah. Oh, Heath Ledger. Yeah, yeah, where, yeah.
Heath Ledger is the Joker. Because, like, I didn't know at the time, like, people were complaining about Heath Ledger being cast as the Joker online. I'm like, I didn't follow it closely at all in middle school or whatever.
It was all just, like, gay jokes about Brokeback Mountain. Like, that's like,
yeah. But, like, he was a big star. And then he dies, like, 4 or 5 months before the movie comes out. And, like, the trailer drops. And it's just like, whoa, I didn't know you could do this with that.
Yeah,
I didn't know comic, because, like, comic book movies were very, like campy, pulpy, kind of, like, you didn't know you could do this, like, dark, gritty thing with it. And then it's like, oh, yeah, Heath Ledger becoming the Joker led him down a path of drugs, and he died. Like, that was the story, and then it became the biggest movie, maybe the biggest movie of the 2000s?
Like, yeah, yeah, arguably.
Arguably, yeah. Like, yeah. I'm thinking, like, Lord of the Rings, that... Maybe, like, there's obviously a lot of big movies in there, but I feel like when I'm just talking about, like, apex blockbusters, like, I feel like Lord of the Rings or that, like, I guess you could say Iron Man for what it led to in the 2010s, but I don't think it was that big at the time.
But Iron Man at the time didn't have, like, the cultural cachet. I remember, like, trying to get my friends to see Iron Man 2, and none of them wanted to see it at the time, and we were all in high school.
Yeah. It didn't have that culture. It gets looked back on in that lens, and a lot of movies do. But, like, having lived through it was a lot of a lot of the movies that came out were, like, maybe Pirates of the Caribbean. That first one was huge too.
Well, for a lot of people, like, Iron Man felt like almost like, comic book movies at the time were like Daredevil or something like that, or the Fantastic Four movies. Really, it's like they're fun kids movies, but they're not great movies. And it wasn't until later that Iron Man had the whole thing.
But it wasn't until The Dark Knight when it was like, oh, you can do something more with this. Like, there's more subtext and layer to these kind of stories that you can tell. But that's enough of that. But just the Heath Ledger is the only kind of connection I can make of, like...
But even then, we had, like, at least, like, a decade plus with, like, Heath Ledger. But again, yeah, this movie just plays so well. And the ending of this movie, I want to talk about it, like, the lighting on that of them going into the police station. Or not in the police station. The planetarium again. And just how it's, like, using, like darkness so well and shadows so well in a way that's, like, very, like, thrilling and just, like, oh, my God, like, you don't expect, like, there's so much lighting. And it's shot so well. And it just blows you away.
So Plato's character he's, like, very tragic in this story. He falls in love with Jim Stark immediately. After seeing him, Jim Stark just moves to this town. We've, like, barely talked about the movie, by the way.
Yeah, I realize that. Yeah, yeah.
we barely talked about this movie. So quick plot recap, because we're not going to go on for too long about this. Moves to this town. He's clearly troubled. Like, in the drunk tank with Natalie Wood's character and Plato's character. Plato's character doesn't have his parents. He ends up being like the really primary driving force of that ending, where they go to the abandoned mansion. Fun fact, that abandoned mansion, Tommy, it's been featured in another famous movie.
Sunset Boulevard?
Mm-hmm. I
can see that.
That's the mansion, yeah. And it was destroyed 2 years later for an anonymous bank building. Should have been a historical landmark, that abandoned mansion. But like, I felt like it's got this subtext of this like kind of suicidal like teenager, right? Like this invincibility of a teenager, right? You're that age, you think you can live forever. I think the thing that I really loved the most about this was after the car crash, after the knife fight, James Dean, in that great breakdown to his parents, wanting to turn himself in. He goes to the police station. He doesn't do it. And then they go to the abandoned, him and Natalie Wood go to the abandoned mansion. Plato meets up with them. They let in, they hang out. The goons that think that James Dean has ratted on them are chasing them. They find him at this place here. But it's interesting that it explores the parental relationships, right? Like, it's very, especially for 1950s, like the dad is the stern figure, but not in James Dean's house. He's like this very submissive, like he's wearing the apron. He's doing all these things where he just doesn't respect his father at all. So it's like this rebellion against authority.
Like, well, the movie does really feel extremely rebellious in a way, where like maybe now if you watch it, like you're like, oh, this isn't that much. But like you think of 1950s and like how conformity filled in the 1950s are known for in their legacy. And this movie comes out, it questions parental authority. And like, I can imagine like so many people, like literally there's a talk in the DVD special features in the beginning of this movie when they're talking and they said like, you know, some people like did not want to have this movie screened. Like some theaters were like worried about it being like, oh, this is a movie where kids are questioning parental authority and going on these like wild like chases and stuff like that. We don't want to influence our kids that way. So it's just like insane that this movie was able to get away with this. Again, I thought the Hays Code would have squashed something like
this. I mean, it was censored in Britain with release scenes cut. Most of the knife fight was cut and not shown until 1967. The film was banned in New Zealand.
Yeah.
Out of fears it would incite teenage delinquencies, only to be released on appeal the following year with scenes cut and an R16 rating. It's also banned in Spain, where it had to be smuggled into the country for private screenings and not officially released until 1964. So like, we're going to look at it now in our modern lens and having seen like a whole bunch of crazy stuff and going, yeah, this is tame. But it's not tame. Like the undercurrent of it is not tame, but there's that moment of clarity for James Dean's character where he wants to turn himself, like he just wants to do the right thing. He's tired of like clearly he has problems and it's just gone from place to place to place. He's tired of running. He's tired of his parents, like not really raising him at all. And he wants to just turn himself in. And then that undercurrent, like, you know, because like he's kind of this like weird agent of chaos early in the movie, like getting into the knife fight, like kind of with Buzz's crew and these like the ruffians, hooligans, whatever. And when Plato goes insane, because Plato goes insane when he sees the check that his father who abandoned him sends, that's just for child support. And the mother had moved to Hawaii. So he's just raised by the housekeeper. Like it's a very sad situation. So he's just kind of like slowly going insane and mad over it and takes the gun. James Dean is so good in there where he walks into that planetarium, talks Plato down off the ledge, gets the gun, takes the clip out, being like, you're not going to hurt it. He's like, you know what I mean? Like that was not who that character was at the start of the movie. The start of that movie's character is about the chaos, is about driving face first off that cliff, but he faced that cliff. He's faced reality. Like he's grown up in this movie.
Yeah.
And it's done so subtly and just so organically and naturally, which kind of contradicts my one problem with it is like Plato going insane. Just it feels extra, if that makes sense.
Well, it does almost feel like from the beginning of this movie that Plato has a few screwlesses, to say the least. Mm-hmm. I mean, we're introduced to these characters. it's pretty much like Jim Stark is, James Dean. He's taken to the juvenile detention center of a police station.
I love the opening. Can we talk about the opening credits? Movie star moment with the title crawl of him just like rolling around in the gravel.
James Dean immediately just like looking cool as hell, but drunk as hell at the same time. But that's fantastic. And then you have the first like 10 minutes of this movie where like you're introduced to our three characters, and pretty much James Dean's just drunk as fuck. Judy broke curfew violation, and then Plato killed a litter of puppies. It's like, oh my god.
Yeah,
went away to the point that my girlfriend screamed out like she hates when dogs die. She's like, what? No.
Oh yeah, I couldn't. My girlfriend is the exact, like, if anything happened, like I was talking with her about Marty Supreme, and I had to, because I was like, I went to go see it, and she's like, it's 2.5 hours. If you want to see it again, I'll go. Like, okay, cool. And then the dog's not treated the best in that movie. And I told her, I was like, it's not abused, but it's not treated great in that movie. She's like, yeah, I don't want to see it then. So yeah, that is gruesome and disturbed. And it's clearly, it's all this reaction to bad parenting really is like the cause of it. It's clearly taking whatever was in that psychology book that they adapted. They clearly are taking it from that. Where Judy, for example, her relationship with her father, they're sitting down for dinner and she like goes to give her father a kiss. And she's just like, he's just like, don't do that. You're too old to give me a kiss. Like goes, it's like, where's the love? Like, are you kidding? It's your daughter. Mm. It's just,
it shows off pretty much like the differences between each of the parental structures these people had, that like pretty much like nobody's in there for Plato, and like pretty much Plato probably should be locked away if he killed like a thing of puppies. Like, that's a red flag.
That's serial killer behavior.
Yeah. So when you get that and you introduce the characters, like, okay, wow, this is what we're going for. And it almost makes, doesn't shock you at the end that Plato like goes out in a blaze of glory. There's no other way this character was going to go.
Mm-hmm. And he's obviously gay. Like when Judy and Plato first have their meet at the race, and he's just like, yeah, he's my best friend. He only speaks when he needs to. Meanwhile, they've talked in the movie for 2 seconds. Like he just has the hots for him. That's very funny in that way. But I think it's interesting that like James Dean's character coming face to face with death quite literally matured him and led him to
just, he aged like 20 years in that moment,
just like led to did a hostage negotiation without coordinating with anybody else, and I was so impressed with that, the way that was done. It kind of blew me away that like that subtlety and nuance was in that script, and it just really elevated the whole movie for me.
Well, you know, it does blow me away, and like the fact that like even the actors who were playing the parents, like the guy Jim Bacchus, he was known for Gilligan's Island. You still have heavy hitters in this movie, and it's crazy that for a movie that originally was thought of like as a B picture, just has so much star power coming off of it. Where even like an eighth guy off the bench, Dennis Hopper, ends up becoming a superstar. Jim Backus becomes a lovable sitcom character.
Yeah.
So when you go and going again, it's like, okay, like wow, it's fantastic. I mean, this movie just deep roster. Again, another deep roster movie recovering.
Well, we're cutting into it.
I am a star.
We'll continue.
I'm a star. I'm a star. I'm a star. I am a big, bright, shining star.
Who is the star of the show? I mean, we've talked about him the entire time. It's impossible not to. It's James Dean. This is, this is a perfect capture of the style of the time of the old world and the new world of that era, kind of coming together here. It's Elvis. It's covering Elvis mania. It's weirdly about the psychology of it too.
Yeah,
in a deep way. It's full of terrific performances, but this is James Dean's movie. This was a movie star arriving and gone before he even arrived.
Yeah, literally, it's like a guy like dying right before he comes out. Well, yeah, yeah, but literally, this is the easiest one we've probably done in a while, where it's just like, who's the star of the show? James Dean, the guy who became like a pop culture myth. He joined up in the ranks of like even like Michael Jackson in his heyday, of like Jimi Hendrix, of just like American Marilyn Monroe. These are American pop culture figures where you can see like a movie. If a movie wanted to do a cheap thing of like, we're in the 1950s now, all they need to do is like show James Dean in a red jacket. It's like, okay, I get where you're in now.
I mean, go back to Pulp Fiction. Like, there's definitely in that diner scene, right? Like, there's somebody dressed up as James Dean there.
Definitely, without a doubt.
I feel like we covered a lot of the performances here.
Sorry, we haven't touched upon at all is Everett Platt as Inspector Ray Fremrick. I think there's a really good, like, nuanced performance of a guy who, like, understands that something's, like, not exactly right with these kids, but not sure how to, like, be there for them in a way, like, where he, like, in an ideal world would have been, like, a surrogate father figure for these characters, especially for, you know, Plato and Jim. I feel like Jim, he had the most relationship with him in the end of the movie, where he's able to talk to him back and forth. But it's just, like, a guy who's just, like, still an authority figure, but still not, like, perfect. The guy coming to grips with that.
Yeah, it's just, there's a lot of subtle nuance to this movie, and it's a part of the reason why we're talking about it 70 years later, and I think they'll still talk about it 70 years from now. Like, I think this movie will have that kind of legs. I think it's the combination of things but I think James Dean's star power is the primary reason we will continue to talk about it. But it is a time capsule movie in a way of just capturing 1955 Americana in a middle class way.
Yeah. To put that even like Grease like pretty much like parodies this to an extent.
Oh yeah. I mean this is Lynchian. This is the prototype of David Lynch, the white picket fence, what's underneath.
Yeah, right?
Blue velvet. What's underneath the dirt? Like this is that to a T.
And I forget if we like touched upon this, but I feel like that has to be part of why Dennis Hopper was cast in Blue Velvet. That definitely had to play a part. It's like, the lineage between movies.
You know what? I would have to look into that, but it would not surprise me. It would not surprise me one bit.
Ah, are you ready, comedy partner? Waka waka.
Okay, Tommy. Would Rebel Without a Cause work as a Muppet adaptation?
I think so. I mean, I could easily see Kermit. You have to sanitize a little bit. I could easily just see Kermit, like, dressed up as James Dean.
Leather jacket?
Right there. Leather jacket. Just Kermit in that leather jacket, trying to pull it off. Miss Piggy's Natalie Wood, and then Plato is, like, either Fozzie or Gonzo. I feel like Gonzo makes more sense.
Yeah, he's got Gonzo. He's Gonzo. Yeah, you just have this, like, great supporting cast of characters for it. I could see it, but it would have to be sanitized a little bit, maybe a little more slapstick, like I'm thinking of the car race, like you have them shoot out of the cannons and have to pull the parachutes, and then other guy just like shoots, does like the Team Rockets blasting off again and just shoots off into the sky. Well, like, there's little ways to sanitize it out, but there's work you can do with it. And I'm sure if we dissected the Muppets, we could probably find homages to this movie, because it's truly stunning to me how I like watching this and this movie, like everything is borrowed from this in some sense of the word.
There is a thing from it's Rizzo the Rat, and there's something called Rodent Without a Cause that they did. it was in the Muppets 1998 calendar, and it's Rizzo the Rat dressed in a black leather jacket and then sporting a James Dean haircut.
Can you share it?
Yeah, hold on.
share the screen.
Yeah, it's almost disappointing that they didn't go with I'll put it in the chat. That they didn't go with like a Rizzo the Rat, like, or wearing the red jacket thing. Hold on, how do I share the screen?
It's fine. All right, while we're doing that, review time. Do you want me to give me, while you get that ready, I'll give you my score at 5 first.
Yeah, go for it.
So Rebel Without a Cause is a interesting psychiatric look into the teenage mind, like the first real instance of teenage division, because children up until World War II just worked instead of, you know, getting to rebel against the system. So it has this weird intersection, and a lot of times these movies were kids across the tracks, but this is the first time we're really seeing James Jean's Rodents Without a Cause.
Yeah.
That's so ridiculous. But it's the first time we're really seeing this kind of examined, and then you cross it with James Dean, shooting star, all-time performance, truly electric. When you hear about the mythos of it, and it, if you've heard the mythos of this and you've had that inkling of, like, should I watch this movie? Like there's no way it could, like, James Dean couldn't have been that good. Like, watch it. It is effortless. It is one of the greatest performances you will ever watch captured on film. This is a 4 out of 5 for me. This is a great movie. Beautifully shot. A weird time capsule of teenage life in 1950 in like a darker side of things, like just maybe a little bit more realistic to, and more true to home than people would care to admit. Looking back on it, 4 to 5. Tommy?
Yeah, I'm shocked you didn't go higher, but this movie is, there's a reason why we're talking about it so many years later. It's just like everything plays out the screen. James Dean is just such a magnetic performer that, like, it's tragic what happened, but it helps with this movie where it just, like, it gives it so much more of a legacy, where we could have easily seen Steve McQueen, like, James Dean become a Steve McQueen type figure in the 60s or 70s. But we're robbed of that. And instead, we get this one great performance. We get two other good movies too, but this is the shining star moment. And other thing is filled with just so many great little heat checks. Dennis Hopper is so much fun. It's like just a little like henchman that doesn't give a lot of lines, but everything about it is just like fantastic cinematography, lighting. And we go 4.5 out of 5. It's a movie that plays very modern in a way I didn't expect. And all it takes is just great acting and good direction.
Good direction. I feel like the acting's elevating the screenplay a little bit here, even though there are subtle moments that I really like in it. But it's a tour de force. It's iconic. Like, I think of American Graffiti, and I'm just like, yep, this borrows from that a lot.
Yeah.
It's there. Right. Tommy, any final thoughts before we wrap up this episode?
Well, thank you guys so much for listening. You can find us on social media. That is at CNetPod. That's on Twitter, Instagram, TikTok. And we're also on Blue Sky at podcnet.bluesky.social. And while you're at it, leave us a 5-star review on Apple, Spotify, wherever you get your podcasts. Helps us out, helps us grow the show.
Thank you all so much for listening. We will see you next week.